Du lytter til Radio 24/7.
Das ursprüngliche Sprachfunk.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der i ført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der den her uge skvulper en masse skummel software rundt, software, som vi bruger hele tiden. Når vi går på sociale medier eller på nettet i det hele taget, så spioneres der imod os. Softwaren kigger så at sige tilbage på os, gemmer alt, hvad vi laver og sælger det videre til annoncører, stater og efterretningstjenester. Vi vælter rundt på nettet inde i en black box, en sort kasse, og nogen kigger ind til os og tager noter, og vi aner de facto ikke, hvad de her oplysninger bruges til. Men måske behøver det ikke være sådan. Errol Balkan, som er min gæst her i dag, han står bag firmaet IndieE, hedder det, eller bare ind.ie, hvis man vil ind på websitet. De står blandt andet bag et lille program, der hedder Better, der beskytter en mod uetiske websites, og som gør oplevelsen på nettet sikrere, lettere og hurtigere, som de skriver på hjemmesiden. Det kommer vi til at høre mere om. Hans firma er lille, det består kun af ham og hans kone og en hund, en husky. Jeg har som sagt besøger stifteren Errol Balkan. Vi taler engelsk sammen. Jeg afbryder ham nu og da, og for at du kan få en lille oversættelse. Welcome, Errol Balkan, IndieE. How do you actually pronounce the company name?
It's Indie. It's just Indie. When we got the domain, we thought we were being very clever, at least I did, because it just spells Indie, but with a dot in it. Yeah. But everyone, and including VoiceOver on Mac, thinks that it's ind.ie or ind.ie. It's just Indie.
So
it's a vanity domain.
Yeah.
But thank you for having me.
Your company, you describe it on the website as a tiny two-person and one husky social enterprise striving for social justice in the digital age. Who are you and what is that husky doing there?
Well, it's me and it's Laura. And as you said, we are a social enterprise. So our goal is to solve a social problem, which in this case is empowering human beings, people, to have ownership and control over themselves in the digital age, which is a key component of social justice in the digital age. And the husky, well, he usually just lies down in a corner, and he's very cute, and he doesn't do much coding, unfortunately. And we're trying.
You could take pictures of him and put them on the internet.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, we're just a very tiny, small social enterprise working for this goal.
You used to live in the UK, but as you write on your side, we moved away from the UK, and at the time, Cameron's data grabbing clutches. What was happening in the UK?
Well, we decided to move away when the Conservatives got into power again for the second time, and because they had an agenda, and that agenda included a referendum on Brexit, and we could see it happening, and of course, unfortunately, it has happened. They also wanted to push the IP bill. The Investigatory Powers Bill, also known as the Snooper's Charter. And one of the clauses in this is that it will be illegal, basically, in the UK to create any communication system that doesn't have a back door in it, that the government cannot listen in on. And our goal is to create decentralized communication systems, decentralized infrastructure for the next generation internet, where no one can listen in. Where if I'm talking to you, then what I'm saying goes from me to you directly and from you back to me with no people or no men in the middle. So that would have been illegal, actually. So when we realized that this was a possibility, and of course, that's also passed now. I hate being right about these things. These are not the kind of things you want to be right about. These are the kind of things you want to be wrong about. But that's all also passed. So before all of this happened, we started looking for a new place, and we ended up in Malmö.
I'll just do a bit of translation.
Of course.
Errol Balkan her, han fortæller os, at ja, det er rigtig nok, de har den her husky med i det her firma, men det laver ikke ret meget andet at se sød ud. De har tidligere boet i England, ham og hans partner, men er flyttet til Sverige ovenpå de her love, som englænderne er i gang med at indføre omkring, hvordan at der for eksempel kræver, at der skal være en bagdør i software, når man installerer det. Det kan han ikke umiddelbart leve med. Det var en lov, som i sin tid bare var på tegnebrættet, da han flyttede, men som altså nu er blevet vedtaget, som han siger, det er endnu et sted, jeg har fået ret, at det er sådan et sted, jeg ikke har lyst til at have ret omkring de her ting. Errol Balkan, your main product is called Better. Your Better is supposed to protect us against what you call unethical websites. Mm. What is an unethical website? How do you define that?
Well, an unethical website or an unethical technology product is one which at its core does not respect the human, which does not respect human rights at its very core. And that is true for mainstream technology today. Most of our technologies do not respect human rights as a core and do not respect your privacy, which is a core human right. An ethical piece of software or technology is one that does respect human rights and also goes beyond that to respect human effort. So it's something that's functional and convenient and easy to use. And hopefully will even go beyond that to respect human experience so that it is delightful and beautiful to use as well and actually improves our experience. So these three things combined are actually the core of the Ethical Design Manifesto, which we published a few years ago. And really, it's all about respect. Respect human rights, respect human effort, respect human experience.
Det, som de har lavet på Better, det er, at de har lavet sådan et etisk designmanifest, som handler om, at man skal respektere menneskerettigheder, man skal respektere menneskeværd, og man skal repræsentere det, som mennesker gør og deres arbejde. One of the things you're having your fights with and against is cloud computing. It's right. General stuff. The cloud is everywhere, we are told, but you do not like the cloud. What's wrong with it?
Well, there's a Free Software Foundation sticker that I really love. It says, there is no cloud. There are only other people's computers. And that's what it comes down to. When we talk about the cloud, the Google cloud or the Amazon cloud, what we're really saying is that your information and your technology is hosted and owned and controlled by someone else. And this is, of course, the norm today, again, it's also at the heart of the issues that we have. A cloud is a centralized system, so it goes through a center, and these centers are the Googles and the Facebooks that we have today, and they have ownership and they have control, and hence they have power. They know everything about us. We don't know anything about them. So if we're going to fix this problem, we need to create decentralized alternatives. We need to basically take our technologies and our data and have individual ownership over them if we want to have individual sovereignty in the digital age. So that's why the cloud's is really problematic because when you say cloud, just think of a man in the middle. Think of somebody else that knows everything that you're doing that, in essence, owns and controls you. Whereas with a decentralized or a peer-to-peer system, you would be in control and you would be in ownership of yourself, essentially, in the digital age. Because that's what it comes down to.
I keep wondering why the reason they named it the cloud is because it's fluffy.
Well, yeah, and they are very good at public relations. I mean, if you go to Google, you see the cute doodles, the Google doodle of the day, right? And it's beautiful. I mean, how could they be evil in any way? So there is definitely this focus on aesthetic, on form. Google actually has people that they employ with the title of storyteller. So ask yourselves, what are the stories that they're telling you? They're not telling you how they actually make money. They're not telling you that they're watching you all the time and they're watching your family and they're watching your friends and that they're profiling them and that they're exposing that information to their customers who pay them money for it or exploiting it themselves. They don't tell you all this. That's the last thing they want you to think about. They say, look at the value you get out of it. Look at our features. Look at what we give for you for free. And of course, it's not free in any way. It's a very, very high cost. It's a cost of our human rights and our freedom.
They used to have a slogan at Google called "Don't be evil," which many of us liked a lot.
Yeah. The person who didn't like that from the very beginning was Eric Schmidt, who was CEO and then is now executive chairman, of course, of Google. And they removed that several years ago. So, I mean, that should tell you something. But he apparently always thought it was very silly. And when somebody asked him once, so what is evil? He said, it's whatever, I think he said, it's whatever Sergey Brin tells me is evil.
So they used to have
it's a meaningless term.
But it was kind of reassuring in some way. I think it had some nerd factor to it, where a lot of people were saying, okay, they have to make money, and that, but as long as they kind of keep this up in front and saying we're not going to be evil, then we understood them.
And this is the problem, because again, it stems from us not understanding their core business model and not understanding that they cannot act against their core business model, even if they have a phrase like don't be evil as a guiding motto. Because what Facebook is, or what Google is a factory farm for human beings. It's a factory farm. So we can't expect them, we can't expect the factory farm to act like an animal sanctuary just because they have a motto. A nice motto, or just because they have, you know, cute doodles. They're still a factory farm, and they're always going to be a factory farm. Maybe a more successful factory farm, maybe a less successful one, maybe they'll go out of business, but they're always going to be a factory farm. They're never going to be an animal sanctuary. We're the animals in this analogy.
Ja, Balkan taler om, vi taler lidt om Google her i den her samling, og hvad Google ligesom gør, og at de lever af. Og det sidste, vi nåede frem til her, det er, som man siger, det er Google er virkelig en menneskefarm, altså et sted, hvor man lever af at høste data fra os, og så sælge dem videre til rigtig mange. Vi har også diskuteret det her slogan, som hed Don't Be Evil, som var et slogan, som Google havde indtil for nylig, hvorefter den ene af stifterne mente, at det var lidt for fjollet, så det har han fået afskaffet her for nogle år tilbage, men det var ellers noget, der ligesom gav en fornemmelse af et eller andet. Og der er faktisk en ekstra ting ved Google, vi er lige nødt til at tale om, nemlig noget, der hedder Google Teddy Bamsen. You hold a lot of talks, and one of them you mentioned the Google Teddy Bear. What is that?
The Google Teddy Bear was a patent. As far as I know, they haven't actually built it, but a patent for a teddy bear, a toy, for kids, with microphones and with cameras in it that would watch your kids as they're playing with it, that would hear your kids, talk back to your kids. And of course, all of the information that it gets, all of the visual information, all of the audio information would be sent to Google, analyzed by Google, stored at Google, and used to profile your kids. So that's just a patent. But we do have smart toys. We have Hello Barbie. I think that was one of the first ones that came out. And now there are lots of companies making toys that can listen, at least, to what your kids are saying. And there are, of course, devices that can see your kids as well. Some of them we put in their rooms to make sure they're safe. And a lot of times, all of this information is going to some company and is being analyzed by some company. We call them smart, right? Smart toys, smart watches, smart televisions, smart cars, smart cities. The question we should all be asking ourselves is, who's getting smarter about whom? Is it you getting smarter about yourself? Are you the only person who knows, who's benefiting from this, who's getting more insight? If that were the case, it's okay. But that's not how technology works today. Today, corporations, and by extension, governments are getting smarter about you. And that is not a status quo that's compatible with democracy. In fact, I would say that we don't have democracy today. I would say we have a corporatocracy ruled by corporations. And so this is really, you know, fundamental to democracy and to human rights and our freedoms in the future, that we get this right going forward. Because right now, I would say, you know, we've lost this battle. We are not sleepwalking into a dystopia. We are in a dystopia. The real question is, how do we chart a progressive, positive path forward towards greater democracy, towards greater freedom for human beings in a digital age?
A lot of people who say would very much disagree with you when you say we're already living in a dystopia currently. They would say this is utopia. Everything is fine. We're having lots of money, lots of entertainment. We can watch Netflix. We have very nice machines, and everything is working.
I think what you meant by that is that a minority of people in the world with a lot of privilege would disagree with what I said, and that's completely true. However, if we look at the world in general, I mean, Oxfam released a statistic in January of this year, where eight men, not women, have as much wealth as half of the world's population, poorest population combined. So eight men have as much wealth as 3.5 billion people in the world. So we live in a world of systemic inequality. Now, the baseline for certain things might be higher, as, you know, some neoliberals will be very quick to point out. You know, we might have better mortality rates, infant mortality rates. We might have less people dying of certain infectious diseases. But, and that is true. But we also have the greatest inequality we have ever had, and it's an unsustainable inequality. We have climate change on the verge of running amok, and we're still denying it. We have the refugee crisis. These are all symptoms of this systemic inequality within a system that Shoshana Zuboff from the Harvard Business School calls surveillance capitalism. So it's all interrelated. You know, we can't see technology as something that exists in a vacuum. We can't see the social issues or capitalism as something that exists in a vacuum. And if there is a problem here, it's not fundamentally a technology problem. We have a capitalism problem. And the problem is that capitalism has won entirely, spectacularly won. And it's just not compatible with democracy, and it's not compatible with a sustainable future.
Just a minute. I think Mr. Newby's here.
I think I'm ready.
You're ready to go surfing?
Surfing? No, I thought you were going to teach me how to get on the internet. Oh, yeah. Oh, surfing on the internet.
But we're going to work that World Wide Web
thing. World Wide Web, absolutely. I guarantee by the end of today, you'll be taking your wife and kids surfing on the net like you were a pro.
Yes!
A computer with a mouse, a modem.
Wow, this is a powerful computer.
And you should also have at least 4 megabytes of system RAM.
Hello, Margaret.
If I were there, Margaret, I'd throw my hat in the door before I came in.
Du er inde i aflyttet på Radio 24/7. Vi taler med Errol Balkan fra firmaet Indi, som blandt andet står bag en app, som man kan putte i sin iPhone, og man kan også putte den på sin computer, som hedder Better, som beskytter en mod det, han kalder uetiske websites. Vi har siddet og talt her omkring Google og omkring den kontrol, som de her store firmaer er ved at få over. Så der har han så lige nævnt det her begreb, der hedder overvågningskapitalisme eller surveillancekapitalisme. Altså vi har nu en masse store firmaer, som simpelthen lever af og plyndrer os for data. Han siger også, at når vi kigger på et begreb som smart, smart city, smarte ure, så skal man hele tiden tænke på, hvem det er, der bliver smart omkring hvem, fordi at det måske i virkeligheden mere er staterne og firmaerne, som finder ud af mere omkring os, end vi egentlig kan lære omkring os selv. Han mener også, at demokratiet som sådan er truet. Errol, we were talking about surveillance capitalism as a term. How do you see this progressing? Where is it going to end?
Well, if it keeps going the way it is, it's probably going to end with the extinction of our species. Because surveillance capitalism is basically the feedback loop between surveillance, which is about the accrual of information, and capitalism, which is about the accrual of wealth. And the feedback loop, the relationship between that and what technology adds to that is that it acts like an amplifier. So we've always had inequality, right? We've never really had an equal world. But why is inequality widening at such an exponential rate? Well, that is the influence of technology. That's what's different about today, where we're at today. So what we're seeing is this inequality widening at an exponential rate because of technology. And, it comes down to our core assumptions of society, of what is success within capitalism. And it boils down to this notion that we can have infinite growth with finite resources. Now, you either have to be an economist or a madman to think that that makes sense. If you have a closed system and you expect finite, infinite growth within the limited resources that you have, you are at some point going to go extinct. It's like bacteria in a petri dish. You know, you put some bacteria in a petri dish, you put some nutrients there for the bacteria, and you seal the petri dish, the bacteria will grow. They will exponentially increase in number until they reach their most successful population one generation before they go extinct because of lack of resources. And in this analogy, the petri dish is the earth, and we are the bacteria. So the core question is, can we act smarter than bacteria in a petri dish? I hope we can. But if we can't, we're just one species on one planet somewhere. And if we do go extinct, well, I don't think anyone's going to care. But it's important for us. I think it's very important for us as that one species that we do make the right decisions. And making the right decisions, I don't think, involves anything more complicated than acting in a way that in which we are acting with enlightened self-interest instead of the so short-term selfish way in which we're acting. And that's probably just an interplay between our low-level or lower-order evolutionary traits, you know, reaching for the next source of glucose and dopamine. These things kept us alive when we were in our primitive stages. You know, if you reached for the next source of glucose and you put the next apple you found in your mouth, you survived. Today, if you do that, we have such an excess of food that we become obese. In the same way, reaching for the next source of glucose, you know, today that greed has created an unsustainable inequality. But at the same time, I'm optimistic because we have higher order evolutionary traits. We've created families. We've created societies. We take care of the vulnerable and people who need our help. So I think it really comes down to, your question comes down to a battle between our lower order and higher order evolutionary traits. And it might look like the lower order ones are winning right now, but I think there is hope. There is hope if we embrace what makes us truly human, that we can carve a future, you know, where we get to move beyond this unsustainable inequality and really have a chance to explore the potential of our species.
Carol Balkan taler om, at vi er nødt til at komme tilbage til vores menneskehed, altså vores måde at være menneskelige på over for hinanden, og at vi i øjeblikket kigger ind i en verden, hvor kapitalismen er gået amok, og hvor det er meget, meget svært at se, hvor vi skal komme ind, hvis vi ikke finder på noget bedre. You're also talking about it's all a question about, let's say, controlling data. We as a modern human beings, we are pumping out data about ourselves all over the place. But it's a question of control. Who controls these data? Who is currently controlling us in that sense?
Well, I mean, currently it's corporations and by extension governments. But we also have to understand what data means. For one thing, it's a very lacking term without any sort of a qualifier. Because we use the same term data, which just means information, really, when we mean information about rocks, as well as when we mean information about people. And if you think about that, that's very problematic because I cannot emotionally hurt a rock. I cannot imprison a rock. I cannot kill a rock. I can do all of those things to people. So if we talk about data in general, it's either quite meaningless or even worse than that, it's quite dangerous when we're talking about data about people. Because if we have all of our regulations set to protect rocks, for example, then they're not going to do a very good job of protecting people. So let's get that right initially. Let's say we're talking about people right now. If we're talking about rocks, then data about rocks should be owned and controlled by everyone. It should be in the commons. It should belong to us all. But data about people should be owned and controlled by the people themselves. And the reason is because data itself, the nature of data is such that if you have enough data about something, then you approach having, owning and controlling the thing itself. Let me give you an example. I have a small statue. If I have enough data about this statue, I can take a 3D printer and I can create an exact replica of it. So think about what I can do if I have enough data about you. I don't want to 3D print you, but I do want to simulate you. I do want to understand you as well as I can and then exploit you by manipulating your behavior. So data about a thing, if you have enough of it, approaches the thing itself. So when we're talking about data about people, let's understand that what we're talking about is people.
You're using the term people farms.
Yes, I call Google and Facebook and these startups that all have the same business model of farming people, people farmers.
But when you mentioned, you say this is possible to actually to kind of recreate other persons via data. How good are they at doing that currently?
I would say we're still at a very primitive stage, which doesn't mean that it's not remarkable what they can do. But even that is also problematic because as much as it's problematic if they have a very high fidelity simulation of you that's very close to who you are, it's It might even be a bigger problem if they think that they do, but they have something that doesn't really represent you. There was a documentary a while back called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And in that, they interview this person and they ask him, so would you go on the internet and search for how to kill your wife? And how about various murder weapons for doing this? And how about ways of hiding the body once you've done that? And he says, yes, I would search for that. I have searched for that. I've searched for nearly all of those things. And they go, well, is that because you're a murderer? And he says, no, it's because I write crime drama for television. But what if, because of these searches, the police showed up at his door? Because Google thought or Facebook thought that he was actually looking to murder his wife. So it's as problematic when these companies get it right as it is when they get it wrong about you. And also there are times where you won't even know because we don't have algorithmic transparency. We don't know what the algorithms are doing. They're not in any way. They're all closed. They're proprietary. So maybe you don't get a loan next time because I don't know, Facebook thinks that you're hanging out with too many people who are low income, or because Google knows that you live in an area that has a lot of defaults, so you don't get a loan. Or they think they know that. Maybe they're wrong. It's very problematic. There's a really good book called Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, which I would highly recommend that you read about that issue specifically.
Her til sidst, at vi lige nævnte en bog, der hedder Messes of Mass Destruction, det vil sige
Math Destruction,
like,
yeah.
Mass Destruction, like, det er matematik, og den handler blandt andet om algoritmer, og hvad der er problemer omkring den, den vil Errol Balkan gerne anbefale alle at læse. Vi taler om det her overvågningskapitalisme begreb, det her med, hvordan de her store firmaer blandt andet er i stand til at lave nærmest store kopier af os, og hvad problemer det giver. Han giver det her eksempel, hvis man nu havde en statue, og man havde tilstrækkeligt mange data om den, så ville man være i stand til at 3D-printen, og det vil sige, at man kunne i virkeligheden lave flere udgaver af den samme statue. Det er det samme, som de her store teknologifirmaer gør med os alle sammen. Herhjemme, der kigger vi jo i øjeblikket ind i, at vi har et stort amerikansk firma, som er i gang med at lege med noget, det man kan kalde for predictive policing. De hedder Palantir, de skal samarbejde med Rigspolitiet og politiet om at lave en stor ting. Jeg tror lige, jeg vil spørge Errol Balkan om, hvad han mener om det. You know, in Denmark, we currently have a cooperation between one of these big data companies called Palantir.
Oh, they're terrible.
but they are in cooperation with the Danish police and the Danish intelligence service to make a predictive policing.
Oh, wow.
System and wow. And have gained access to a lot of Danish systems. What do you think about, you say they're terrible, why?
Oh, I mean, Palantir is Peter Thiel. As you know, Peter Thiel is now on Trump's advisory board in the U.S. as well. And of course, they're a surveillance company. That's what they do. Yeah, that's very worrying to hear that. Because, you know, it kind of seems to me that certain people read 1984 or watched Minority Report and didn't think that these were warnings, but thought that they were instruction manuals, because that's the only thing that can explain what's happening right now. What we live in today and what we're increasingly living in is some sort of a feudalistic panopticon, really. And we seem to be lovingly, you know, just marching towards that and going, yes, what could possibly go wrong? It should scare the hell out of you that that's happening. It really should.
Palantir is out of, it's a name out of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, they're not even hiding it. Palantir is the all-seeing stone from the Lord of the Rings that the evil wizard Sauron, is it Sauron? I'm not good on my Lord of the Rings, that he uses to be able to see everything and uses it for, you know, his terrible aims. They called it Palantir. They're actually proud of it. It blows my mind. It really does. I don't know what to say. I mean, I shouldn't have to say anything. There's a company called Palantir, and it's working with your government. Be afraid.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
You're also talking about what we are generally talking about is human rights and the internet. How do they actually work together? Is it possible?
Of course, definitely. I mean, and let's also be clear about the difference between the internet and the World Wide Web. The internet is, for the most part, a decentralized system. We built the World Wide Web on top of that as a centralized system. And, of course, we like to think of the web as decentralized, but it's not. It's client-server, and those servers are the centers. Those servers are what's owned and controlled by Google and Facebook, and those are the things that, you know, have scaled to become the monopoly that they are today. Are human rights and the internet compatible? Of course they are. It's not about the technology itself. It's about the business models, and it's about the social and economic system in which we are operating today that's not compatible. Capitalism is not compatible with democracy. We've been told the opposite for many, many years. And for a while, it seemed like they could get along. But we can very clearly see that if capitalism wins and it has won, then democracy is what is lost, or is what suffers and is lost. So that's the problem that we have, really. We need to be able to regulate the current mainstream that is abusive to human rights. We can't do that because the people who should be regulating are institutionally corrupt. The institutions are corrupt. We have lobbying. We have revolving doors. We have the same corporations that our policymakers should be regulating to protect us, spending hundreds of millions of dollars and euros to influence the same policymakers who should be regulating
them. Because the people who are supposed to be regulating all this stuff is mainly, currently it's the EU.
Well, and if you look at the European Commission, for example, Transparency International has a beautiful website where you can see exactly who the top lobbyists are and who the top lobbied commissioners are. And if you then look at the legislation that comes out of these commissioners, it is entirely in the interests of the companies that have been lobbying them. They're only talking to these people. So they go to Google. I mean, we call these things co-regulation. We call them multi-stakeholderism. We call it public-private partnerships. Really, all of this is just, these are euphemisms for institutional corruption. We say to Google, hey, Google, come to the table and tell us, how should we regulate you on privacy? That's like saying to a factory farm, hey, come to the table. How should we regulate you on animal rights? And they go, oh, yeah, we have some ideas. Yeah, yeah, here, this is how you should do it. This is ridiculous. This is corrupt, entirely corrupt. It's institutional corruption. Lawrence Lessig has been talking about this for many years, and he actually briefly ran for president of the U.S. on this one issue last year. So it's a very important issue. Unless we can remove the influence of corporate finance from public policymaking, we cannot regulate effectively. But even if we could regulate effectively, regulation is a short-term instrument. It stops the abuses, if effective, stops the abuses of the current mainstream and gives a chance for the alternatives to arise. We need to also fund and build those alternatives. And we can't do that within the current system. We can't do that with venture capital within a Silicon Valley model of technology. We need to actually fund them from the commons as well.
What about, let's say, we have this Danish woman who's in the European Commission, Margrethe Vestager. She's saying she wants to. She's currently trying to do some legal stuff against Google, and she's also considering Facebook. But she can stop it then.
It's interesting that, and I'm familiar with her and her work, and it's all around the notion of antitrust and competition law. It's interesting that the only times that we can actually effectively limit what these companies are doing is under consumer law. And again, this makes sense because we're operating under capitalism. So we're still thinking of people as consumers, though. And the only way we can protect them is under consumer law. We're not thinking of them as citizens. We're not even looking at how we can protect them in terms of human beings and people with human rights. So it's great that, you know, at least under competition law, we're making some progress, maybe. But we're not even touching on the core citizen issues and the core human rights issues in terms of regulating these companies. And that's very, very important that we do that.
Når Margrethe Vestager går ud og siger, at hun vil have fat i Google og Facebook, og nogle af de her folk, der laver store og spektakulære sager om det, så rammer hun dem via forbrugerlove, ikke via etiske grunde. Det mener jeg, at Balkan er et problem, at vi ikke ligesom kan gøre noget, hvor man kan sige, at vi kan ramme dem på menneskerettigheder i stedet for det her. Og det er typisk, siger han, at, at det er det eneste sted, man kan komme til at angribe dem. Og han mener også generelt, at EU's institutioner har gjort et rigtig dårligt job for at beskytte borgerne rundt omkring i det her. Man har for simpelthen et system af korruption, kalder han det simpelthen lige frem, og det kommer man nok også til at vende tilbage til. If we look at, again at Denmark, because that's where the program is broadcast and it's mainly in Danish, then we got, we are currently looking into some sort of new, we have got a new minister of disruption.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah. That's his title? In September, we have had some very large meetings with Singularity University and Google and a company called Boston Consulting, right, talking about Industry 4.0, which is a vision of exponential growth and a lot of robots and some AI. What do you think about? Do you think will that be that would be a great way to for Denmark to move forward?
Well, if Denmark wants to bow to Silicon Valley digital imperialism, yes, that would be a perfect way for it to move forward. In fact, you know, you guys should just completely open your doors to Silicon Valley and to a handful of feudal lords from there, so that they can come and they can basically create in their own image, with their own ownership and control, your new digital infrastructure. You should just let them build all of the new roads, all of the new parks. They're all going to be shopping malls, and they're all going to be controlled by Silicon Valley. But, you know, you'll be able to buy whatever you want. So, and that's all you want for the future, right? You'll just basically be a fiefdom of Silicon Valley. So I think this is great. This is probably the direction you should be going in.
Are we looking into, let's say...
I hope my sarcasm
comes
across.
Yeah, it does. But are we looking into what we can call a Silicon Valley world?
Well, that's what we live in right now. I have no illusions that we live in anything else. That is the world that we live in right now. The question is that the world we want to live in? Or do we want to live in a world where instead of just a couple of people in Silicon Valley, we actually have agency. We have ownership and control of ourselves. We get to decide how we use technology as a tool for ourselves, and not to live in this panopticon that's being controlled from somewhere else.
But when you talk about it like this, and you keep talking about bad capitalism, a lot of people say, "Oh, he's just another socialist trying to change stuff." Are you having a socialist vision here?
I think the only reason that I'm doing this here, let me tell you why I do what I do. And this is a summary of my life in 2 minutes. I was 7 years old and I got a computer from my dad. I was very privileged. It was an IBM compatible computer, and he put it in front of me and he said, "Use it. You can't break it." And he had a basic manual with it. And so I started programming when I was seven. And back then, you owned and controlled your computer. This was the personal computer era. It was the last time we actually had decentralized technologies. And a computer just worked for you and nothing else. It didn't spy on you. If it did, we called it spyware, right? And it was malware, and we understood it, and we killed the malware, right? And so I started making things for myself, very hedonistic. I loved it. It was amazing. I could make spaceships. I could fly through space in the space that I'd created. You know, it's magical. And then the internet came along and the web, with the promise. Tim Berners-Lee's original vision was that it was a read-write medium, a democratic medium that anyone could take part in. Unfortunately, and this is easy to say, you know, with 25 years, 30 years of hindsight, the architecture, the design was centralized. It was client and server. And these servers were these centers that I mentioned earlier. And when we put this into an enzymatic vat of capitalism, we actually encouraged those centers to scale vertically, to grow, and to coalesce with all of the mergers, etc. And we got the monopolies that we have today. So we've ended up from coming from a decentralized world of personal computers. We've now ended up in a centralized world of the web. But I think this is a pendulum. Because before personal computers, we had a centralized world of mainframes. So we went from centralized mainframes to decentralized personal computers to centralized web. And I think the real challenge here is the pendulum's now swinging in the other direction because it is not a sustainable place, this centralization that we're in. What does decentralized technology look like in the internet era? So that's really why I'm approaching this today. And I don't think the labels that we have, you know, capitalist, socialist, communist, etc., I think they're meaningless today. All we need right now is enlightened self-interest. And I don't mean selfishness. I mean enlightened self-interest. To understand, for example, let's say I have a chemical factory and there's a lake next to my chemical factory. The short-term quarter-on-quarter profit capitalist successful way of thinking about it would be, let me dump all of my toxic waste into this lake by my company, and I will make a lot of profit this quarter, I'll make a lot of profit next quarter, and I'm successful. My children die of cancer because of that lake in 2 years' time. Ah, okay. So was this in my self-interest, really? Was it in my enlightened self-interest? It was my short-term self-interest. That's all we need to do. We don't need philanthropy, and we don't need charity for this to make sense. If we actually are smart enough to understand what's in our own longer-term interests, that's all we need.
Albert Balkan taler om, at det, vi har brug for, det er ikke idéer som, at vi er socialister eller kommunister eller kapitalister eller alt muligt andet. Det handler om, at vi skal begynde at agere i det, man kan kalde oplyst selvinteresse. Altså ikke bare selvinteresse, men oplyst selvinteresse, som man tænker lidt længere frem. Han nævner også, at han som 7-årig fik en computer, det er mange år tilbage, og dengang der var det, der kendetegnede computeren dengang, det var, at de arbejdede for en, der blev ikke spioneret på en, og de var heller ikke på nettet. Man kunne fuldstændig selv kontrollere de her maskiner, og det er en situation, vi langsomt har bevæget os væk fra, hvor vi nu får meget centralt styrede programmer, som vi ikke selv har kontrol over, hvor det er meget svært at programmere i dem. But I was wondering, Albert, currently one of the biggest influences in modern tech is Singularity University and Singularity, yeah. The group of singularitists all over the world. They have a vision, which is, they will call that enlightened self-interest of a world where technology will, this centralized technology that we've been building will be so intelligent that it will save us all. Should we just lay back and wait for the singularity to happen, and then everything will be all right?
Yeah, I think Singularity University's vision is that a very small group of white American men will control everything, and that we should trust them because, of course, white American men should be trusted, right? This is a colonial vision of the future. It's a colonial vision that's technologically deterministic, of course, but it is colonial because remember, someone's going to own and control these technologies. They're not building these technologies in a decentralized way. Quite the opposite. They're building it in a centralized way where they know everything that's happening. We're talking about machine learning. Let's talk about IBM Watson. IBM can see and understand and learn from every piece of data that goes into Watson. So the way that these technologies are being built are to aggregate the power of a very small group of people in a very small part of the world right now. And it is an entirely colonial mindset. It is no different from the white man bringing the fire to Africa and saying, hey, natives, here's the fire, right? In terms of the fire today, we have artificial intelligence and machine learning and quantum computing and whatever else Singularity University is throwing out today as their buzzword of the hour.
Singularity University står efter Albert Balkans mening for, at det er ligesom de hvide mænd, der kommer til Afrika og fortæller folk, hvad de skal gøre. Og han mener også, at det er en meget lille gruppe mennesker, som kommer til at få noget ud af det her. We are approaching some sort of end here, but we need to get around another part, which is what are we going to do about this? Because we have the general problem is we have a man in the middle problem with everything we do on the internet. How are we going to solve that?
Here's a very specific, focused, and feasible plan for how to solve this. One, we build decentralized technology. So we give everyone their place on the internet, right? Which they own and control, and which they can be reached from very, very easily as putting in a website address today. In fact, we can do it with website addresses. So imagine that everyone had their own place on the internet. And that this basic service we saw as a human right and that we supported from the commons with our taxpayer money, right? This doesn't mean that the government builds it and runs it. We can actually have independent organizations build and run these things if the system is interoperable. So any company, any small company, any larger company can provide this basic service being subsidized by the government for the basic service. And they would be competing on providing the best service possible. And that's the role of a corporation as I see it, to provide the best service possible. That's it. Not to lock you in, not to analyze your behavior, not to own all this information, not to have all this power over you, to provide human beings with a service, period, and to compete on that. So we have this core where everyone has their space on the internet. Now then, let's take all of our things, our smart toys, our smart watches, our smart tablets, our smart whatever, right? Our cars. They all connect to this space instead of connecting to Google, instead of connecting to IBM, instead of connecting to, you know, whatever else is in Silicon Valley or that we have here as a center. They connect to your center that you own and control, right? And then we can even move beyond this. We can say, okay, this is the core. This is what we believe human dignity and human rights deserves, like dictates today. But it's an interoperable system that's supported from the commons. So any one of these organizations that's providing the service can also extend it. We've created an ethical core on which to play on now. So then an organization can say, well, I want to add these features. Okay, great, do that. You need to share it back with the commons because it was supported by the commons and you wouldn't be able to build it otherwise. You need to share what you build back with the commons. But this extra service that you provide, you can charge for that. So this isn't in any way incompatible either with having competition, with having, you know, a continuation of our entrepreneurial spirit. In fact, it's probably better because we're giving an ethical core on which that can flourish. But the core thing is we support the commons going forward. So you can't compete on lock-in. You can't compete on owning certain things that other people don't have, but you compete on providing the best service to them. And for certain things above the basics, all these organizations can charge whatever they want to charge on top of that. So we create a healthy economy on top of it as well. All this to say, this is not infeasible in any way. I've personally prototyped as one person with negligible funds, having sold, you know, two of my own apartments in Turkey to fund what we're doing and had one round of crowdfunding over the last 4 years. I've actually built a prototype, a first generation prototype of such a system. And so I've seen it work. But this is not just a technological thing. We need the political will. We need to prototype these things. I'm actually working on a second generation prototype of this next generation internet. It's given me hope that the European Commission Next Generation Internet Initiative actually does seem to be quite legitimate, at least right now. I was expecting a lot of bullshit when I was in Rome last week and I was listening to some talks from there. But the head of that initiative, Jesus and Fabrizio from there, their talks gave me a lot of hope that it's actually they really do want to do something along these lines. So we're going to be talking with them as well. We can do this. There's no infeasibility. All we need is the political will and the imagination to know that something better is possible and that technology is not some inevitable single vector. When we hear about technology, we only hear about the Silicon Valley story, about the Singularity University story, the Google, Facebook, IBM story. We need to start writing our own stories here in Europe, and not just for ourselves, but because, you know, the future of humanity and the future of the planet really depends on it. We can't keep looking at America for leadership anymore. I think in the Trump era, that's very, very clear. It's our time. We need to stand up. We need to lead, not just for ourselves, but for the whole planet.
Errol Balkan har en idé om, at det der skal til, det er, at vi virkelig laver et nyt internet, hvor vi er uden for de her ting, og hvor vi har hver vores egen platform som en form for menneskeret, så vi bygger en etisk platform, vi kan bygge på alle sammen, som ikke er styret af de her firmaer. Så det er internettet for mig, og ikke med de her firmaer i toppen. Just one last very short question. I was wondering, well, this is a very big plan. You're currently scheduling, which might come true, which might not. But what can I do on an individual level after having listened to this program? What can I do to make the internet a better place?
In the very short term, and I'm also going to interpret that as meaning to protect myself as well from this, I would say, of course, I'm biased on this, but get some sort of tracker protection. I'm not saying get mine, the one that we work on, although that would support us if you do. But you mentioned Privacy Badger by EFF. There's also uBlock Origin, which is, again, free and open source. And also Better, which we make, is free and open source. So even if you don't want to pay us anything for it, you can go on our source code repository and run it and build it yourselves if you want to, and maybe help us improve it as well. So it's all free and open source. Or uBlock Origin or Privacy Badger, but use some sort of tracker protection. Beyond that, there are certain platforms that you can prefer over others, especially if you can afford to right now. I mean, unfortunately, privacy has always been something that the rich could afford and the poor couldn't. And it's not very different today, unfortunately. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg says privacy is dead, but when he buys a house, he buys the four houses around his house. So for him, privacy is not dead. He's talking about you. But for example, if you can afford an iPhone instead of an Android phone, there's a reason the iPhone costs a bit more. I mean, for one thing, of course, Apple's making a profit. But also, their business model is different to Google's business model. In fact, Apple is probably the only example I can give at that level, the multi-billion dollar huge corporate level, where their business model is to sell that iPhone to you or to sell a Mac to you. And when they do, they're happy. So for them, privacy is an absolute competitive advantage. It's something that they can compete on without breaking a sweat that would make their main competitor, Google, go bankrupt if Google tried to compete on privacy. Because when Google sells you an Android phone, they're not happy. They're only happy when you start using that phone. And that's a very different place to be. For example, we can't sell Better on the Google App Store because they've disallowed that because it's entirely against, of course, their business model. Of course, if you have the time, if you have the technical capabilities, then maybe look at Linux, look at open source solutions. But you do have a trade-off there between, you know, then you have to keep certain things secure as opposed to Apple doing it for you. Use VPNs, but, you know, there are a list of trusted ones, more trusted or less trusted, virtual private networks when you're on an open Wi-Fi network, for example. That's very important. Depending on your threat vector, if you're under more threat, because you're a journalist, et cetera, look into Tor and other things. So it really does depend on what your threat vector is as well, you know. But if you're just a regular person, then I would say, you know, tracker protection, using a VPN, using a platform that isn't built on spying on you. I mean, and Google is, Microsoft Windows, for example, 10 is built to spy on you. So try and stay away from these platforms. It's not easy, unfortunately. You know, the web is a sewer. Technology today is a sewer. It's not easy to avoid the crap. It's somewhat possible to not drown in it. If you will. But that's why it's so important that we can fund these alternatives, that we can build these alternatives. So the best thing you can do is also, you know, support those of us that are trying to do that. We are negligible in number today, unfortunately. Our voices may seem louder than our stature, but that's thanks to, you know, maybe programs like this. But remember that if you're hearing me talk here today, Silicon Valley and the representatives of Silicon Valley will be talking at 1,000 events at 1,000 places. So support what we're doing. Tell your friends. And at the very least, understand that this is a problem. Even if it doesn't affect you personally right now, or if you don't think it does, it will the next time you try to get insurance. It will the next time you might try to get a loan, or you might try to get a house somewhere. So even if it doesn't affect you right now, understand that it's a problem, and at least maybe start looking into it and telling your friends.
Harold Balkan fortæller her, at han mener, at vi skal sørge for at lave nogle ting, der blokerer den her form for tracking. Det er sådan det mindste, man kan gøre som almindelige mennesker, og så skal man indse, at det her det faktisk er et problem, som vi er nødt til at håndtere fremover. Og man kan overveje at støtte nogle af de mennesker, som går rundt og laver de her ting. De er ikke særlig mange. Til gengæld er der utrolig mange inden for den her Silicon Valley-afdeling af det, som står og råber op alle mulige hjørner kanter. Thank you very much for coming, Harold Balkan, founder of Indie and the maker of Better.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. for eksempel ingen, der kan forbyde mig at styre den sporrum. Au, den kører rigtigt. Ding, 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 ding. Ding, ding.
Aflyttet forbi for i dag. Min gæst var som sagt Errol Balkan, stifter og ejer af Indie, og en, der har programmeret det program, der hedder Better. Et program, der beskytter dig mod uetiske websites, som for eksempel Facebook og Google. Jeg hedder Anders Kærulf, og jeg er Aflyttet, vender naturligvis tilbage i næste uge med mere nyt fra det her overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor i en skov fyldt med øjne, der aldrig blinker, og langsomme filmende fly over os og store firmaer, der lever af at kigge ind i os, mens vi ser på hinanden, ser ind i øjnene på dig, der overfor, mens vi drømmer om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.